Ladies and gentlemen, good evening. I'm Stephen Duker, Director of Tate Britain. It's my great pleasure to welcome you to the 2008 BP British Art Lecture. The BP British Art Lecture annual event that sits at the heart of an annual programme which BP supports at Tate Britain, and indeed they've been supporting a programme here since 1990, which means, believe it or not, next year we'll be entering the 20th year of our relationship with BP, which has certainly been, you know, extraordinary from our point of view. Their support allows us to rehang our collection displays every year, to bring out works from the basement that would otherwise be unseen. They support an educational programme, a learning and activity programme for children. BP Saturdays, you may have heard of them. We've had Loud Tate, we've had Tiny Tate. I think last month we had Kinetic Tate. That's become a very vital part of the programme as well. And they also support an annual exhibition here this year based on drawings from Tate's collection. So they're really very much part of the life of Tate Britain and of our role in sort of spreading the word about British art around the world. And it's a great pleasure to welcome the Group Chief Executive Tony Hayward and his colleagues here this evening. And this evening also coincides with a kind of parallel event, Tate's publication of a major three-volume new history of British art. This is a project that's been organised under the editorship of Professor David Bineman. Involves, I think, 97 scholars from around the world, British universities, American universities and museums. But it translates all that erudition into what we hope is a very accessible introduction to 1,400 years of British art from 600 right up to the present day. So, you know, it's just the kind of history, actually, now I think about it, that someone like Andrew Marr might have written if we hadn't got there first. Andrew, as I think you know, is presenting this year's 2008 BP British Art Lecture. It's a really incredible pleasure to have him here. He has actually spoken in this auditorium before. He took part in a Britishness conference we had here around 2000. And indeed, he sat as a member of Tate Britain's advisory council for a number of years, I think, from our beginnings back in 2000. So he's been a great friend and supporter of British art. He's very interested in contemporary art, as I'm sure you'll know, wrote fascinatingly quite recently about the process of sitting to David Hockney. And his History of Modern Britain, the TV programme, which I'm sure you all saw, won many awards. The books that came from that series were also feted. He's a great champion of Darwin. I'm rather worried about the prospect of him moving into British art, actually. But for the time being, he's occupying his time on the Andrew Marr Show and in many other ways. But we're really, really delighted, Andrew, that you've given up time to speak to us this evening. So over to you.
Stephen, thank you very much indeed for that. Thank you all for coming, first thing to say. There's a game that people quite often play, which is, what is the single most deadening or depressive word that you can think of in the language? And for me, the answer is PowerPoint. So it seemed to me to be ridiculous, really, to be talking about painting without anything beyond, God help us, me, to look at, which is why there are two paintings here, which I will be referring to later on. But they're there for when your minds drift from what I'm saying. You can simply look at those. I am here simply, really, as one of those people who has almost all his adult life walked around these galleries and other galleries and got a vast amount of my kind of inner glitter, or whatever it is, from looking at paintings. I am here as an unabashed amateur, non-specialist, non-art historian, observer of paintings. Through most of my professional life, I've been involved in talking about politics and history. And so there will be a slightly sort of historical and political note to what I would like to say this evening. The overall theme, if there is one, is the Britishness of British art. And that's, of course, a question which naturally obsesses a place like this, given that it is the repository of so much extraordinary British art, with various other parts of the Tate family. But it's a very, very difficult question, and I don't think we can begin by talking about the Britishness of British art without accepting that to a large extent there is no nationalism in art. It's piffle. There are a series of artistic techniques which evolve, and they go from wet plaster and sailcloth, and they end up with formaldehyde and blowtorches, all sorts of computer programs, the invention of small metal tubes of paint. But almost as soon as one technique has been invented, it spreads almost everywhere around, certainly the Western art family. Clearly, the instinct to make art is as primal and as early and as universal as the instinct for dance or music. You see it everywhere. The instinct to draw and to make shapes is universal. I've just come back from Brazil, and you see on the walls of the barrios in Brazil the most extraordinary, you wouldn't actually call it graffiti art, that's unfair, the most beautiful pieces of work done by people who seem to have almost nothing else. Eat your heart out, Basquiat. And, you know, you come to the great centres of Western civilization, you go back in time, you go sideways, it's everywhere, it's universal. There is no nationalism. Of course, there are national traditions and there are groups of artists and they move from one country to another. But even here, you find very little real nationalism. There's a tradition of very, very fast movement. One technique, you get somebody down in the south of Spain who invents a clever new way of doing the kind of roughly wobbly bits on the clothes of constipated absolute monarchs, and I'm thinking of Velázquez, and very, very quickly, that way of just making a bit of shorthand with paint has spread across Northern Europe. Everything moves enormously fast. And yet, I do think you can talk about Britishness in art in a limited but still quite useful way. One way of approaching it might be to compare art with, by which I mean painting and drawing primarily, I'll talk a little bit about sculpture, mainly painting and drawing, with some of the other arts. At one end of the spectrum, you could take British or English literature, and you could say that thanks to the extraordinary bastard vibrancy of the English language and the early development of a reading culture, English literature has been about as self-standing as you can imagine. Of course, it's not self-standing. You can't have Shakespeare without the great classical writers and the storytellers of the Italian Renaissance, and Boccaccio and so on. But it is an extraordinarily powerful, autonomous, semi-autonomous story that runs right the way from Chaucer to Joyce. It is as self-confident and as self-standing as any artistic tradition in the West could be or has been. So that's at one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum, and here I'll get into trouble probably, you could talk about British or English music. Now, British or English music depends almost from the beginning on continental traditions. You run right, you know, you start with the great madrigal makers of Italy and France, and you run through the beginning of what we, I mean, by music, I don't mean pop music, I mean complicated music designed to be heard over a relatively extended period of time, or what is absurdly sometimes called classical music. If you think of the original composer the English really took to their hearts in a big way, it's of course Handel, followed by Haydn, who comes here for subscription concerts, followed by C.P. Bach. And you go through into the 19th century and British English musical life is utterly unthinkable without Mendelssohn, without Beethoven, and ultimately without Wagner. You know, Elgar, completely impossible without Wagner. So that's another extreme, if you like. The musical tradition